Sexy Positive Podcast Season 2. I'm your host, Isla Oxman, and today is a very special episode. I am here with my brother, Elias. As you know, or if you don't know, Season 2 is all about love, relationships, and family with chronic illness. So Elias is the first family member to be on the Chronically Positive Podcast, and it's extra special because Elias is a scientist, and he does research in rare diseases, which is very relevant to a lot of our listeners. The reason why we thought it would be a really good idea to do this episode with Elias is because of the current events going on surrounding science. So Elias is going to inform us more about these far-reaching impacts on these cuts on science.
Thank you for having me on. I'm really excited to be here, albeit I wish for, as we're soon going to learn, maybe better circumstances. But I think this is going to be a really informative talk just to share with you and your followers what's going on.
Well, I'm really excited to learn about it because I know what you do, but like I don't really know as much as I probably should know. So we're all going to be learning together here today. So let's get into it, shall we?
Buckle up, folks. It's time to science.
So what do you do?
So I help manage a rare disease research lab. That's where my expertise is. And I like to kind of think of myself in our lab as disease and genetic detectives. I'm going to go for my good analogy that I like to use because as I'm sure you're experiencing and also our family, when I've published papers in the past and I send it to them, they're like, oh, congratulations, Elias. I wish I could understand the title.
Yeah, I don't know the half of the things he says.
So I'll basically break it down this way, and this is kind of like the basic framework of how translational, and we can define that term in a minute though, genetic disease or rare disease research works.
Okay.
So I'm going to count on you to put graphics over what I say, otherwise I'm going to look really silly. But you know what? If I look really silly, that's fine. You'll keep watching. So let's say we're a house. This is your house, right? And in order to build your house, you need a set of blueprints, right? You need to figure out how you build the house. So I like to think of the blueprints as your genome, your DNA, right? 23 chromosomes, you know, stuff we learned in
biology.
Fun fact, we were in AP biology together.
I got a C and he got an A.
That's why I'm a scientist.
And I'm not.
Anyways, back to the analogy. Blueprints, please. Blueprints.
Yes,
blueprints.
Sorry. We don't have to hold them.
I don't. My arms are getting so tired. So the blueprints, if you can think of each blueprint, is a different part of your body, right? Like we have the same instructions in all of our cells in our body, but our blueprints, you know, define what each different kind of part of our body are going to be. So one page could be your eyeball. One page could be your calf muscle or your spleen or your pancreas. I can stop listing. But anyways, what's on a page on a blueprint?
White writing.
Technically, yes, because of the contrast, but all the different pieces and the dimensions, essentially the instructions of how to build that part.
Yes.
I'm going to test you. So each of those different parts we can think of as a gene, right? I, for example, in every room, I need a 1-inch screw. And that 1-inch screw could be what we call like a housekeeping gene. You're going to find it in every single room. But not all parts we find in every single room. For example, in the basement, we might not find a door to the outside. Well, actually, in our basement, we do have a door to the outside. So that's a horrible example. Carpeting. We don't have carpeting in our basement, right?
No.
But we don't. Oh, mom and dad tore out all the carpet in our house. That's also a bad example.
Don't use our house as an example.
Oh, but I love our house. This is at our house right now.
We're actually in a shed.
This is the shed. Anyways, the shed doesn't have hardwood floor in here, right? So not all parts need to be on all the pages, and we can think of that as the genes in our body, right?
Yes.
Are you following me
Yes.
so far? Okay, I know there was a lot of
trying science
there.
Science is not my strong suit.
So let's say you have a genetic disease. A genetic disease or a mutation, right, or a variant would be a change in one of those parts. So let's say in the living room. I made a change on the blueprints and the windows were gone. What would happen to the house if the windows are gone? The house might get really, really cold, but the house is still structurally sound, right? What if I took a load-bearing wall out?
The wall would cave in.
Right. So genetic disease can be a spectrum of the rooms getting cold to the walls caving in. Sometimes, though, we don't know what the defect is in the blueprints, right? Which, you know, is a situation that's really real. And the reason why people go see a geneticist or go see a specialist in the first place. So my job is kind of like that engineering forensics of it, where I know the house is getting cold, but I need to figure out what's that part of the house that's different. And if I figure out what part of that house is different, which is usually what we might get from a geneticist, right? A potential candidate variant. Mm-hmm. I then have to do some kind of, whether it's with animal models or cell models, kind of reverse engineer why would the house get cold. And that's my analogy. If it works for the chat here or the comments.
I followed it. And it's a pretty low bar over here, so I think.
I'm glad. I had to talk to some people about my analogy. They approved of it.
No, it's a good analogy. So you understand what's going wrong. So then your research then goes on to help find cures for these diseases.
Correct. So, for example, if in my end of the equation, I figure out what's the gene, what's the part in the blueprints of this house that's making the house cold, chronically ill, let's say, for that matter,
yeah.
That then gets coordinated and passed on to clinicians. And then the clinicians have a better idea about what could we potentially look at for therapeutics. Another really important thing is if the part is the same in a group of people and you just figured out that the insulation is a little bit thinner, let's say, you now have a community of people with thinner insulation who are getting cold. And that's like the first step to characterizing like a rare disease and building a community around it too. And we're discovering like new diseases all the time too, which is like really crazy. So there's still a lot out there that we need to resolve and figure out.
Yeah. When you give the house analogy, I really think of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome and the collagen.
Thin insulation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so with everything that you do and everything that's going on, what is happening?
So what's going on right now is really breaks down to how the way that science funding works in this country and how the ripple effects really are going to make a pretty dramatic change if these go on for a long time. So just to like preface, the way that most funding works with labs is we're academic research labs. There's different tiers of the way that research can be done. Mm-hmm. You know, there's private industry where you have a company that is investing in something, whether it's a drug treatment or a new technology, either it goes into pharma and becomes a drug, or it's a piece of technology that then goes into academic research, which is part of a hospital system or a university.
Mm-hmm.
Most of that funding comes originally from a government entity.
Right.
In this case, most of it comes from the NIH. So researchers all over the country have these grant proposals from the NIH. They apply for these grants. They get their funding. And the funding allows us to pay for scientists' salaries, allows us to pay for the cost of doing experiments. And also these grants help spur innovation. A lot of them are kind of like calls to action about certain things. So what's been happening recently is kind of a crackdown on what the breadth of grants that are available that there are, but also the funding structure. So one thing that was really big and spurred, if any of you listeners saw or heard or even went to the Stand for Science event that went all over the country, was really tailored around indirect costs, if you've heard of that term. So indirect costs are really the definition of what keeps the lights on when it comes to science. Mm-hmm. So academic science, translational science has to rely on funding because you're not really marketing a product on the other side, right? Like knowledge, gets translated, hence translational science, and then goes to pharma, goes to tech. So how does a research institution pay for the buildings, pay for all the support staff? Because research labs are pretty cool buildings. They're pretty neat. And so anyways, most institutions have a negotiated rate with the NIH, the National Institutes of Health. So recently, they decided to cap indirect cost rates at 15%.
Oh, wow. That's big.
Yeah. And really what that means is the rate is an additional tax that the NIH will pay an institution to essentially subsidize their operation. So if I apply for a grant and my grant is $300,000, repeats over some odd amount of years, and my university has a indirect cost rate of 60%, I get 60, or the university, me, the university or the hospital or whatever, they get 60% of that 300,000 additional. So I, the researcher, let's say get 300,000, but then they get 60%. So that's what, $180,000 in our theoretical example. So that $180,000 pays for the building mortgage, pays for the utilities, pays for the people to clean and do like environmental cleanup and maintenance so we don't pollute our environment.
Super expensive microscopes and
super expensive microscopes
and CRISPR.
And CRISPR and laser beams. Just kidding. There's no laser beam. Well, no, there's definitely laser beams. I've never seen laser beams though in my time.
In your time?
In my time, which is a short time, because
in my day we use laser beams.
You know what they say? Three laser beams and it's a party. So what about my laser beams?
You don't. We were talking about what the money helps.
Oh, yes, 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 yes. So, right, in our example, 60% of my $300,000 grant means that I, the scientist or the researcher, gets $300,000 and the institution gets $180,000. Well, if you cap it at 15%, all of a sudden the university or the hospital only gets mathing in my head.
Not enough.
Anyways, not enough. So what does that mean for science? What it means is that I now, as a scientist or PI, or the scientist, I'm not a PI.
What's a PI?
Oh, vocab term, principal investigator. That's someone who runs a lab, a PhD, an MD, PhD. I have a Master of Science, or does it go the other way? I don't know.
In what?
The text you're going to put underneath this.
I have to put text?
No, I'm just serving you invisible food.
Other way, I think.
Is it this way?
Yeah.
Our PA says that. Wait, it's this way. I have a Master's of Science in Genomics and Personalized Medicine.
Wow.
Which we can talk a little bit about more what that means later. But anyways, back to the issue with the cost cuts. So at 15%, okay, so right. So me, not the PI, but let's pretend I'm a PI right now. I now have a big decision to make because my $300,000, which pays for my staff salary and the cost of doing science, which science is pretty expensive enterprise, I now have to subsidize more things such as the building mortgage, the utilities, the support staff that isn't necessarily a part of my lab. And also our like budgetary structure really hasn't done it. So what does that mean? I hire less people and I can't do as much science because my money is not going as far. So I kind of like slows it down a little bit and kind of creates a situation where it would be like,
well, it's like a domino effect, because then that affects the people in the other categories who are researching cures and therapies. Yeah.
Imagine you have a restaurant, which the patrons are people who, you know, have rare diseases or have cancer, and you have a chef and ingredients to cook up a cure, but all of a sudden you don't have a kitchen. That's kind of the best way to think about it, right? Like, if I don't have that stove in that oven, I can't cook. So the threat right now is that scientists can't cook. And if they can cook less, we discover less.
Wow. So with all that said, what do you think the short-term effects are, and what are the long-term effects going to be?
Well, I think the short-term effects is, you know, in many cases, simply just the disruption that's been done to science. Like if you, I think that there's a lot of hesitancy going on right now where people are, might be a little bit more conservative when it comes to their resources and even hiring. I mean, there's a lot of hiring freezes that are going on, and that's really going to slow the progress of innovation in the short term. I think, though, in the long term, something really important that's coming out of this is people really being turned off or turned away from the prospect of getting into science, or actually closing opportunities to getting into science. This year, there's a lot of articles out there. It's a real thing. Universities are not getting grants that pay for, you know, special PhD or master's programs. And there's been class sizes being reduced going into this year. And I mean, programs just shuttered for the time being.
It's so interesting because there are like these universities where it's like they're very STEM, they're very science oriented. What's going to happen with those?
I don't know. Like if you close or stop a PhD program because it's, you know, based on federal funding and you can't have it, you know, those people like entering these professional roles, whether it's like biochemistry or epidemiology, you kind of lose the next generation. Like,
and this, I feel like it affects our physicians as well, because there's science, you know, pre-med, you take all these biology classes, these chemistry classes, and then all of that.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of that I think is still going to go on at like an undergrad level, but yeah. I think what's concerning with some of the graduate programs is losing or limiting your leaders. So think about it this way, right? Like if the chef can't cook in the kitchen to feed the people at the restaurant, what happens when you start closing down culinary school, right? I think that's kind of the long-term consequence and concern that's really scary.
We have a lot of bad chefs.
Well, no. They wouldn't be bad scientists, but put it this way.
If they don't have the knowledge.
Well, if they don't have the knowledge, yeah. How do you start that back up?
How do you invent new recipes?
You can't invent new recipes. So no more cookbooks, folks. So anyways, no, but that's a good way to think about it is if you lose the next generation of chefs, or if you have less chefs out there, let's say 10, 15 years from now, that's the long-term consequences of what's happening in the short term. So 10, 15 years from now, you can get to a point where you can be like, all right, we're ready to just invest in science. Well, what happens to the people who help teach those programs, or the people who have the technical and the professional expertise, you know, to get this stuff done? So what you do is you're just throwing money at a laboratory, but you can't put any chefs in there. And so you can't cook and you can't feed your patrons.
Right.
And that could have a really profound effect on our ability to make progress. Some of the world's best scientific breakthroughs happened in America, right? Made and spurred here. And
people come to America to learn science.
People come to America specifically to do science. And as a result, you know, if you lose the cooks.
Well, and to be benefited from science, like people come here for clinical trials. And
Or travel to some of our elite institutions and stuff like that. It's going to make us a lot more reliant on the rest of the world. People want to come here.
To get better.
To get better,
and
yes.
And smarter.
Woo! And what happens when you can't come here to get better or smarter? You go other places to get better and smarter, right? Like, that's not good in the long term. Like, that just puts us in a situation where you're not as fortunate to be able to look up whether or not a clinical trial for some rare form of cancer is happening at your state's university.
Wait, speaking of clinical trials, I have a question.
Yes, chef. So, just kidding. I'm the chef in this analogy.
So clinical trials that were going on before all this started, mm-hmm. are there people literally being like pulled and cut off? Like, what is going on with that?
So I don't want to say too much about that because I don't know, and I don't work in clinical medicine. Like, anything that I say, I don't think I'm saying anything that's a medical recommendation about right. what you should do or how you behave. I can't do that. I'm not an MD. I'm not a PhD. I'm an MS. But to your point, I think it depends on the program, because some clinical trials, which are rely on federal funding to run, might be shut down. Right. And what does that mean? It basically means that the research infrastructure isn't there anymore for them to go to a trial site, receive a certain drug. So I think that there are definitely some people, and I think that there's probably stories or maybe, I don't know, resources we can look after this and share to keep people informed and see what if a doctor right. is in that article and makes a medical recommendation, because their doctor. I'm not a doctor.
Not a doctor.
Not a doctor. To make sure that they know what to anticipate, essentially. Right. You know, and there's ways you can look up whether or not all, you know, I think most or all clinical trials are registered on clinicaltrials.gov. I don't know what the deal is with that if you were to look online. And I think a lot of people, too, have been recognizing that you can't just pull the plug on something, because it could really put a patient's life in danger.
Like, if they've been taking this medicine every week for like yeah. 6 months, and then
I think what's probably more likely the situation that people are dealing with right now, when you and I can look and share stuff after this, about would be people who get to the precipice of going on or starting a clinical trial.
They've been approved. To
yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then the trial gets canceled.
And then the trial gets booted. Yeah. And for people dealing with rare cancers or really debilitating diseases that really rely on this, I mean, that's just gutting, because yeah. the science is there, right? But you lose that infrastructure.
Right.
And it's just unfortunate because it's there. It's within arm's reach, right? So that's the current state of my knowledge of clinical trials. But again, to the point I was talking about short-term and long-term effects, yes. right? You start to dismantle this infrastructure, it's a lot more difficult to get back to a place that of where we were.
Right. We get so scrambled up and removed. If things were to get better one day, be really hard to get back to where we started.
Yeah, it's a major delay, and you become less self-sufficient in it.
So what does this mean for people listening with rare diseases?
So for people with rare diseases, I think one thing that's really important to keep in mind is we really don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
We know the prospect of what could happen. So right now, yes, a lot of grants are being pulled. There's a lot of restrictions on criteria of what grants may or may not be able to contain. Mm-hmm. New York Times just did a great article about a list of words that were going to be flagged, including woman.
It's so bad.
It's bad. And bias and unbiased. Well, you know what science is? Unbiased. There you go. Science is gone.
So bad.
It's really bad. So I don't know how far-reaching that is going to be in terms of stopping grants. And as far as the indirect cost cuts go, a lot of that is currently being sued and litigated right now. So I think most organizations they're still trying to get their normal negotiated rate. Yep. But I think people are really trying to brace for how that would change. I think 15% is dramatic. I don't think it's necessarily going to stick or happen, because mm-hmm. it would really, I mean, when I say the chef with all of his ingredients and no kitchen, I mean the full weight of that analogy.
Yeah.
I'm not sugarcoating that at all. But even if it gets capped at 30% or 40%, I mean, that's really going to limit our ability to do things. So I think whatever that outcome is, it might not necessarily be catastrophic, but it might be really impactful. And I think it is going to change the paradigm going forward of like how people go about science and just create like a bottleneck. I mean, great example I think we have all lived through is like during COVID, supply chain issues and things get harder to get, like toilet paper.
Too.
Yeah. So it's like you create a supply chain issue in science. You're not necessarily getting rid of it, but you're bottlenecking it.
Yeah.
So I think the important thing is to recognize that this is likely to have a large effect, but nothing is certain. It's not destined to be catastrophic.
What can people listening do? What are some options from people who are not in science? Is there anything we can be doing?
Yeah, I think biggest thing, honestly, is probably just staying informed. I mean, these are not small things that are happening, yeah. Right? Like these are real people losing their jobs. These are real breakthroughs being stopped dead in their tracks. Stay informed. And go to some of the organizations that are like speaking up for this. Contact your representatives. Tell them how it is going to potentially affect you. And support your scientists.
Share your stories.
Yeah, share your stories. Make sure that you're informed about it. This is a really important issue. And I think one thing that I struggle with this is share the trust in science, mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm.
As in, I don't expect myself to explain what I do specifically is so like vitally important. And I have to explain to you the genetic mechanisms of brain development and how if you cut off this money, it's all going to just come crumbling down and this particular group of people are going to be affected. Like if you're personally affected by that, like you need to know and be informed. But I think what's being like thrown around a lot right now is like people are not trusting scientists, right? Like you really don't need to know all these things. When we drive over a bridge every day, we trust our engineers, right? Mm-hmm. And we're not gutting engineers. So you don't have to explain and justify or every little thing, but just figure out how to get the trust. And maybe figure out, you know, for the people in your lives, where's the distrust coming from?
Mm.
Because you want to be able to bring back the trust and just in the faith in science. We do really cool stuff. And we do it because we're curious and we want to make the world a better place.
Right.
And people healthier.
There's no maliciousness in evil science.
No, I'm a mad scientist.
Mad scientist.
But mad and evil aren't mutually exclusive.
No. Wow. That was a lot of information. A lot of information that I didn't know. Maybe do you have any comforting words for people who are freaking out?
I would say that my comforting words is the scientists are mad. We're all mad scientists right now. And I think one thing in the greater community that's been really interesting and I think exciting, to be honest, is how engaged and networked and vocal the community is getting.
Mm-hmm.
Those involved in science have very suddenly become much more vulnerable with one another and are really closing in because there's really no one who, you know, won't be touched by this situation. It's everything.
Right.
I mean, you know, I think it was like the statistic is fact check alert, if I'm right. Can you put fact here?
I'll put the real statistic here.
I think it's 99% of therapies on market in this country came from an NIH or a federal grant.
Wow.
So everyone involved in this sector is going to be affected, and it was palpable. There was Stand for Science all over the country, all these different events that were going on. And in my years in science, that was, I've never experienced something like that before,
yeah.
That kind of sense of camaraderie. And I think that's comforting in a sense, you know, like I'm not staying up in bed being like, oh, no more money. Where's it going to go? I'm kind of thinking about like, oh, what can I do next? Either how can I get engaged? Or like, what can I think of and collaborate to kind of like kick science off and like cause disruptions in a positive way, like good discoveries, kind of like be bold with what you want to do, live like science is dying. Stay chronically positive. That's my advice.
And come on the show and talk about
science. And come on the show and like talk about science. Like
talk about how science has helped you.
How science has helped you. Yeah. If a listener is out there and you're caught in the throes of this, you know, this is, you know, now to like really put those stories out there.
Yes. For people who, and they probably aren't, these type of people aren't probably listening to this podcast, but for someone who's like, this just doesn't affect me, how is it actually going to affect them?
I would argue that it affects everyone.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I'm going to go back to the chef analogy is just owning this. Can we make the thumbnail like me as a chef, not as a scientist?
Sure.
So let's say 40, 50 years from now, we've done this ransacking of science, right? We are so close to, I mean, literally blasting off into the next era of the ability to create therapies and cures for everyone. I don't know if I've said or you've edited in at this point that my master's is in genomics and personalized medicine.
Right.
So what does that mean? And I think this is the great reason why everyone should care about this. What I have learned in my expertises or research angles is trying to understand about what makes you, you, and how can we create new technology, whether it's therapeutics or diagnostics or long-term healthcare plans that are tailored based on the data of you, your blueprints,
right?
That's really the most effective medicine because it gets to the core of what is wrong about you.
Right.
What's wrong about you, or how can we prevent you from going wrong? If we figure out that the house, this foundation is sinking, what if we can figure out a way to go back 20 years in time while we have the chance to support the house so you don't have to worry about it sinking, right? Like, that's an important thing to know. And that's really going to reduce the burden of health that people experience in this country, whether that's cancer or ALS or POTS and EDS, right? Yeah.
I think what I always say is like, you can become disabled or sick at any point. No one is invincible.
At any point. And I started talking about the chefs again, but we're bringing the chefs back in. So it's 40, 50 years from now. We're on the precipice of having healthcare for you, right? Like the whole thing is for you. And you need a chef to cook. And in 40 or 50 years from now, if there's a lot less chefs, whether they're not trained as well, simply not there, or not as many to go around, doesn't matter how much money you have, you can't cook, right?
So if you think this isn't going to affect you, it will. In some way or another, at some point.
I hope it doesn't affect anyone, and we all live healthy, wonderful, beautiful lives, frolicking sunshine, with sunscreen.
SPF, science!
With SPF is because of science. You know, do all the things to keep ourselves healthy. But yes, inevitably, some of us are going to get unhealthy.
So if research stops, how hard will it be to restart science?
So I think that kind of comes back to the short-term and the long-term consequences that I was talking about. I mean, short-term, you know, if infrastructure kind of like collapses in a way, right? Organizations sell off their properties, they fire their staff, you know, you lose the space for science, let's say. You got to get that back, right? Yeah. So you got to do that. And then you got to staff people and you got to get the kitchen back, right?
A lot of rebuilding.
In the long term, what I was talking about with the chef or the, not the chef analogy, oh God, the chefs, with the graduate school situation, not having as many chefs, you're gonna have empty buildings, right? Like, that's the long-term consequence of saying, again, we're gonna throw all of our money back at science again. Who's going to fill it? You're gonna have an empty brand new lab.
Right.
You might not even, because you might not know how to put the lab together or know what you want to research, right? Like, it takes someone who is kind of dedicated to this idea of service and curiosity who wants to start it up. So just saying we want to restart research could be a loaded question, right? You're going to want to have someone who wants to do it.
Right. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
It sounds like it wouldn't be impossible, but it sounds like it would be a lot of work and take a lot of time.
Yeah, I think the moral of the story here is really just the disruption to it.
Yeah.
If we're running right now, why would we decide to start crawling all of a sudden?
Why are we going to regress?
Why would you do it? I mean, crawling's fun sometimes when you go into a crawl space and the ceiling's too tall and you're like, oh, this is a cool place to hang out.
If you have really bad knees due to a genetic rare disease.
Yeah, thin insulation. It's not going to work out for you very well.
No, exactly. All right. Wow. That was a lot of science for one day.
The science is still sciencing, and I want to make that point, and I think I've made that point. But yeah, look out for science.
Keep science in your heart.
Keep science in your hearts. If you see a scientist,
thank your closest scientist.
Thank your closest scientist. I was going to say hug them, but you should ask first before you hug them.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Elias.
You're welcome. Well, thank you for having me, and keep the science faith. And
trust science.
Yeah. You're going to see me. I don't know if I'm going to do season 3. I might do season 4.
What's season 4?
Oh, I'm already planning it for you. It's like Crash Course meets Magic School Bus meets Bill Nye the Science Guy meets Fantasia from Disney.
Wow. Sounds like a lot of special effects. That's a wrap for this episode. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode with my amazing brother. I hoped you learned a lot about science and what's currently going on and how important it is that everyone is informed, because as we've learned, it will affect everybody. If you enjoyed this episode, please make sure to rate, follow, subscribe, whatever platform that makes sense for you.
Like for science.
We'll be back next week with another awesome guest.
Me again. More science. Science rules. Anyways, thanks for having me, Isla.
You're so welcome.
Let's go eat some Peruvian chicken now.
Is that what we're having for dinner?
Yeah, Dad picked up.
Woo! Anyways, we'll see you next week. And remember that your journey matters.